Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. The University of Eastern Finland has come up with a study published in Seminars in Cancer Biology that says a good vitamin D status can protect against cancer. Well, that's good news because cancer is a major killer, third among, right behind heart disease and stroke, then is cancer, about neck and neck with stroke. So if we can save 500,000 lives a year by just changing our lifestyle or behavior, at least a certain percentage of that, why not? I'll get into that and a lot more on health and healing today. By the way, a lot of people go to our archives. Let me give you our archive number, because not everyone can listen live Monday through Friday, noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time, and Tuesday evening, the Progressive Commentary Hour at 7 o'clock. They listen generally at night. Please write down this number. It is 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. Also today, we're going to hear from Martin Luther King, his I Have a Dream speech. It's a short segment, and here is my question. Right now, with full legitimacy, all of us, and I mean it's a unifying factor, are concerned about police brutality, and that is not all 700,000 more or less police, but those who are violent don't seem to be in any way adversely affected by, you know, the idea that they should be playing by certain rules of decency and nonviolence, and yet they do. And unfortunately, these individuals take the power away from those who are therefore nonviolent but demanding change, serious change. Now, standing between what we should be doing and what ultimately will happen is an enormous amount of money spent by police unions to get different legislators elected, especially those on the law committees. And so all the politicians now say, yes, we've got to do something, we're going to do something, and then they won't do anything, or anything they do is going to have so many loopholes and it'll be meaningless. So I've come up with some ideas. I'd like to hear your ideas. So I'm going to ask you to call in today, and here are the two issues I want to have you discuss. One is, what would you do to help protect the people from all the violent criminals of all backgrounds and races? These people are not out protesting. These people are hurting people millions upon millions of times a year. So we have to have police. But then how do you make sure the police we have are going to use nonviolent methods wherever possible to stop from killing people, especially unarmed people, and not just unarmed people of color, but unarmed Caucasians as well? And if you compare it to other countries, we are far and above all other countries combined in how many civilians, unarmed civilians, the police kill each year. So a lot's wrong with the system itself, not just some police officers. What would you suggest? Secondly, and this deals with something that came up yesterday, a professor at UCLA was requested by one student to be able to defer the exams. And he said no. And he said that, you know, these are the exams and take them. And then other students who weren't in the class joined in, and then they had immediately 20,000 people sign a petition wanting this person thrown off the faculty. And that's where it stands. And this person cited Martin Luther King as, shouldn't you judge a person by their character instead of the color of their skin? A lot of demonstrations now are by very young people who I'm sure are very idealistic and very self-righteous in that what they're doing is the right thing. But what happens when you are a professor in a class and you have to be concerned that with some students, not all, but some students, especially those that have grown up in bubbles, that they want to be deferred to on all issues and what is called microaggressions. If you say anything, if you ask them to do something on a report or read something, and if they feel somehow that's an aggression, they can file Title IX against you and your life suddenly goes to hell. and this is more and more and more. In fact, even when they're wrong on what they're arguing about, they're still able to get away with it. So this is different from the 40 years that I've been teaching in college, thousands of students. This is different than when I was a student in college. This is different. There is a different environment. And yet the safest place a young person could be today is on a college campus. The most rights you could possibly exercise are on a college campus. But should there be a new understanding, and this is a legitimate question, that no longer should anyone have anything to say on a college except the student. The students decide the curriculum. The students decide whether they want to be tested or not. The students decide whether they have to come to class or not. The students decide if they should get an A or an F. The students decide who should be punished for anything irrespective, because that's where we're going right now. And every administration of every college and university is acquiescing to this. So, how does that help prepare these students for the real world, not their bubble? What happens when there's not a group of people on a college campus surrounding a professor, as they did at Evergreen, and shouting him down, and even though he was probably the most liberal professor at that college, and yet he lost in the end, as did his wife, who was also a professor there. And what does that mean for our entire educational system? I'd like your opinion. Our talkback number is 888-874-4888. So where we do support change, and we do support ending any form of discrimination in the workplace or any place, what happens when then people take advantage of the people's concerns for their own ideological and political needs that have nothing to do with bettering society, bettering our communities, bettering the world, making people's lives better, but has an awful lot to do with their repositioning themselves with new power that cannot be assailed? Because the moment you say anything that they have done that is wrong, suddenly they play the race card. This is the danger of identity politics, and it is everywhere today in this country. So I believe we should address this in an open and honest way, especially those of us who do believe Martin Luther King would be a great example and a leader today. But I'm sure he would also, as he was in his life before he was assassinated, he was not revered among many of the leaders within the civil rights movement. People wanted a much harsher line, many. And he did not. He did not believe in violence. He didn't believe in, you know, taking advantage of a legitimate cause for illegitimate, you know, gain. He didn't support that. So would he have any place today? Or would he be considered an outcast, a dinosaur, antiquated, of no value to the younger people? Or would he? These are just questions. I'd like to see your answer and insight. 888-874-4888. Now we'll go to the latest on health and healing. As I mentioned, a good vitamin D intake, generally between 2,000 to 5,000, 10,000 a day, is beneficial both in cancer prevention and in the prognosis of several cancers. That's according to new research. The anti-cancer effects of vitamin D are especially pronounced in the prevention and treatment of colon cancer and blood cancers like leukemias. In addition, high vitamin D responsiveness can be linked to a smaller cancer risk. Vitamin D responsiveness varies between individuals, affecting their need for vitamin D supplementation. It was interesting because just one of those days, yesterday, I got three back-to-back-to-back calls where, you know, I called the people back and I spoke with them, and one happens to be a highly respected person within the scientific movement and a very brilliant man, and he's got end-stage cancer. So we had a long talk, about an hour, and I asked him, are you willing to make changes? And he couldn't give me an absolute yes or no. It depended upon what the changes were, and yet everything within his diet showed that he wasn't using any scientific legitimacy, because I showed him the peer-reviewed literature supports a healthy plant-based diet, not one that you're eating with sugar and wheat and dairy. All these people were cheating on their diets. And all of them are now with advanced cancer. And one person says, oh, well, you know, eat a good diet, but then when you look at the actual diet, there's nothing good about it. And that's a person's perception. You see, we're the last people to know what our true reality is because we're constantly looking in the mirror and intellectually and psychologically photoshopping our image of who we are. Therefore, if we can lie to ourselves, it's easy to, you know, pretend to be something to other people. So the truth of our choice becomes whether we'll live or die, age or not, have diseases or not, be happy or not, have a good relationship or not, be successful at life or not. It's all in the perception, because our perception becomes a reality. If you can't change your perception, you're not going to change your reality, no matter what protocol you're on. So the idea is, when I looked at his diet, he had no vitamin D in it. And I said, well, why don't we take a moment, you go to the peer-reviewed literature on PubMed and just put up vitamin D and cancer. Thousands of studies. Thousands. I'm just sharing one with you. Published in Seminars in Cancer Biology. Written by Professor Carlton Carlberg at the University of Eastern Finland. So what we don't know by intent, then we become intentionally ignorant, which means we're going to make intentionally wrong choices. So take your vitamin D every day. Prevent cancer. Also from the Center for Postgraduate Medical Education in Poland comes an interesting study about evolving role of natural compounds in medical treatment of uterine fibroids. Now, by the way, uterine fibroids remain a significant health issue for many women with a disproportionate impact on women of color, likely to both genetic and environmental factors. And the presence of these uterine fibroids is estimated to be approximately 70% of the population. You heard me right, 70. That's a huge number. So I read this and there's a quote there, and it says, quote, uterine fibroids derive clinical symptoms include pelvic pain, excessive uterine bleeding, gastrointestinal, and voiding problems, as well as impaired fertility. Nowadays, numerous methods of uterine fibroid treatment are available, from conservative treatments to invasive surgery. Selecting an appropriate treatment option should be individualized and adjusted to the patient's expectations as much as possible. So far, the mainstream treatment is surgery, but their negative impact on future fertility is clear. On the other hand, emerging new options have significantly, drug options have significant adverse effects like liver function impairment, hot flashes, bone density loss, endometrial changes, and inability to attempt conception during treatment. Several natural compounds are found to help treat uterine fibroids and relieve their symptoms. And then it goes into vitamin D, green tea, and that's because of the chemicals. It's called epigallocatechin gallate. Berberine, curcumin, these are some of the things that they're saying. Now, if you take each one of those and you looked in the peer-reviewed literature, you'd find numerous studies, especially for curcumin and vitamin D on uterine conditions, uterine fibroids. Also from University of Texas, Southwestern, published in Cell, Host, and Microbe, happiness might protect you from gastrointestinal distress. Yes, how's that possible? Well, it's simple. Serotonin, that's the chemical known for its role in producing feelings of well-being and happiness in the brain, can reduce the ability of some intestinal pathogens to cause deadly infections. That's according to the new research. And so this could offer new ways to fight infection for which few truly effective treatments currently exist. And by the way, the vast majority of research on serotonin is centered on its effect in the brain. About 90% of this neurotransmitter, a chemical that nerve cells use to communicate with each other, is produced in the gastrointestinal tract. That's 90%. And that explains the study's senior author, in this case, a professor of microbiology and biochemistry at the University of Texas Southwest Medical Center, So in humans, let's just visualize this. Trillions of bacteria live within this space. Most of these gut bacteria are beneficial, as long as you're not eating sugar, which will change the bacteria and unfortunately change the level of infections, candida. You'll start having skin problems, including discoloration of the skin, funguses under the nails, poor circulation. All these things come from having the sugar in the diet. And also they feed pathogenic bacteria, which can colonize in the gastrointestinal tract, causing serious and potentially fatal infections. And that includes meat of any kind, dairy of any kind. And because gut bacteria are significantly affected by their environment, then what we see is whether the serotonin produced in the gut can affect the virulence of pathogenic bacteria that infect the gastrointestinal tract. And the researchers work with E. coli, 0157, a species of bacteria that causes periodic outbreaks of often deadly foodborne infection. So that's what they worked upon, and they found, yeah, it makes a difference. So being happy makes a difference in creating serotonin, which in turn helps produce a healthier gastrointestine. So that's just something to add to why we should stay happy. Happy and healthier gut. Healthier gut, less bacterial infections. Also from the University of Western Ontario, antioxidants, there's your vitamin E and vitamin C and zinc, in the brain is linked to improved psychosis treatment. So once patients with psychosis start treatment, some get better in weeks while others take months. And they wanted to find out why was there this disparity. And the Schulitz School of Medicine and Dentistry professor and his team explored the chemicals in the brain with the aim of speeding up the time it takes a patient to respond. And what they found was the more antioxidants you have, like the more good biochemical reactions, like from vitamin C, the quicker your body responds in a positive way. Also, from Isfahan University of Medical Sciences, they looked at the Mediterranean diet, which is not a vegan diet, but it's about 80% vegan. They also have fish and sometimes dairy, but little meat, lots of fruits and vegetables. And they found that that Mediterranean diet is powerfully positive on cognitive function in patients with Parkinson's disease. This was a randomized clinical trial. So that's good news. And by the way, Parkinson's disease is the second most common neurodegenerative disorder. So it can be helped. But I also found in working with a lot of Parkinson's patients that you've got to have a positive attitude. A lot of people don't realize how powerful your mind is in causing these conditions. And the underlying foundation is understand what's causing you to keep relapsing back into negative thoughts, negative behavior, because that's going to hold you a prisoner to your disease. Also, I just read something from the American Cancer Society, and here's what it says. It says they updated the diet and physical activity guidelines, quote, more emphasis on reducing the consumption of processed and red meat and alcohol and increasing physical activity. Okay, well, I would redo that. I would say more emphasis on eliminating the consumption of processed red meat and alcohol altogether, and yes, increasing physical activity. I see nothing in here about the nutrients we know can actually impact cancer in their suggestions. Their physical activity is, 150 to 300 minutes of moderate exercise, or 75 to 150 minutes of vigorous physical activity per week. I would say start at 300 minutes, then go up. And again, they want to emphasize some plants in the diet. That's good. But here's my question. When I was debating people from the cancer establishment on network television and on my radio show over on WMCA and then on ABC, why didn't they start the change then? So if the American Cancer Society is today in 2020, halfway through, saying, yeah, we should do this, how many people then, as a question, as a hypothesis, have died because they were taught moderation in all things? After all, it's primarily genetic. Well, A, it's not primarily genetic, and B, it is my guess that they would have saved millions of lives. So, American Cancer Society, you're a little late to the party. And suddenly, is it safe? Did someone at the American Cancer Society and their board say, are we going to offend any potential sponsors or donors? Are we allowed to say something as radical as eat healthier? Are we allowed to say that publicly? Wow, what a joke of an organization. Shame on the American Cancer Society. I wouldn't support it under any conditions. And how many people have you had oncologists use your patented chemotherapy when they could have had natural non-toxic therapies? So in any case, why it pays to be humble and modest. This is from the Institute of Science and Technology in Austria and Harvard University. So, for example, why do people make anonymous donations, and why does the public perceive this as admirable? Why do we downplay our interest in a potential partner if we risk missing out on a relationship? These are just some common questions. So they have taken a look at when people have positive attributes, they generally try to downplay them. And people who lack these attributes almost always become excessive and effusive in bragging. And what does it say about people who are demanding and demeaning of others constantly? What happens when you're around someone that all they know how to do is put you down or find some normal human flaw and rub your face in it? What does that say about us that we would allow that type of degradation? And what's it say about them? Isn't it time that we simply let these energies and people go and seek out people who have humility and modesty instead of this braggadocio, hyper-alpha masculine and feminine energy? So I think it does. In fact, I've done a new 15-minute, 11-minute, and 10-minute self-empowerment series. It's free. Go to prn.fm. Watch them. I think you'll enjoy them. It's all about happiness and why we prevent happiness in our lives. Finally, from St. Michael's Hospital, barley, yeah, whole barley, lowers not one but two types of bad cholesterol, and that's important. And our next show, I'll talk about what is the difference between hemp seed oil and CBD oil. A lot of people are confused. But we're 23 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to hear what Martin Luther King had to say. And here's a question, and I want you to call in with your response. Would he be invited by mainly the youth of today to participate in addressing bias, prejudice, and across the board in all circumstances, not just black prejudice against blacks, but of all people based upon their income? Because you talk about people who are having it hard. How about all people of all colors who are at the lowest economic standing, who can't buy food, whose children go to bed hungry, who some are out on the streets or living in campers or parked in their cars trying to find a place to sleep at night where they're not harassed or given a ticket? What about all the homeless vets? You see, we have at least 150 million Americans. That's nearly half of all Americans are deprived any quality of life, nor empathy, nor help, nor consideration. Do they not also count? So it's a large base question. I'd like to hear your answers. 888-874-4888. We're going to take a break, and we'll come right back. Please stay with us.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creeds. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. that one day on the red hills of Georgia, sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners, will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream. My four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream.
Well, that was just a little tiny piece of that. It's just as a reminder. At the end of his life, Reverend King was already moving away from the plight of African Americans alone and realizing the plight of all who are poor and disenfranchised as victims of systemic prejudices within the nation's machinery of governance, militarism, and class segregation. So looking at the eruption of protests, which I support, today, what would King have thought or said based upon the legacy he had left? Of course, I believe it would be reasonable for him to be supportive of the nonviolent demonstrations of the legitimate Black Lives Matter. But beyond that, I do not believe he would have believed that the people should be left out, Latinos, Muslims, LGBTQ, Asians, and others. I believe that he would have been critical of Antifa, the looters, but also white supremacists and militant patriot groups. Simply calling a person a racist does not penetrate the depth of threat enough, nor does it help to make fundamental changes. For King, it was making efforts to change the mindset of people by changing their hearts, not through ridicule and condemnation that shows no respect for the individual who holds racist views. Nor does it appreciate the conditions for why a person held racist views. Understanding that, and therefore seeing if it could not be changed, the progenitor, that which created a belief system, could not be changed. And that means you have to change not just hearts, you have to change perceptions, which then change minds, which then change actions, where people begin to see what is sacred in all life, in animals' rights, in human rights. I remember how few of us there were to protest, sometimes one or two, in front of the South African embassy, because it wasn't important to people. It sure was important to those suffering from apartheid in South Africa. And find how many people are marching or demonstrating today for the 4+ million Palestinians living in the West Bank or Gaza, who are in effect living in the largest prison in the world, with virtually no rights, and also no clean potable water and food and medical supplies. It's terrible. Now, I want to see peace between the Palestinians and the Jews. I want to see no Jew hurt nor Palestinian hurt. And those who are the agitators in both sides do not represent all the people. People want to live in harmony. People want to live their lives. People want to be able to have a respected life, a meaningful life. And the moment you bring hatred in, the moment you bring bigotry, racism of any type, the moment you create disparity, then you create disharmony and you disconnect from a positive solution. And that's where we are today, all over the world, and especially here in the United States. So I believe that King said, "I decided to stick with love. Hate is too great a burden to bear." But not for some people today. They live through identity politics, and their whole modus operandi, their whole game plan, is keep people divided. And I believe a lot of politicians, both left and right, are engaged in systemic denial of human rights, basic rights, and the sanctity of life for people that they hold no value towards, only their own little elite groups or their parties or their tribes. So we have a much bigger problem to look at than innocent people being shot of any nationality. And that shouldn't exist, but it does. So let us pull back far enough and bring in some of the wise men and women who've been here a long time, who see the problem with a broader perspective. And I don't hear their voices. They're not being invited onto the forums. But boy, the ranters are invited everywhere. Just a thought. I'd like to hear your points of view on all this. If you have a point of view, please call in, because I have an open forum and I invite people to share their points of view. Now, this is important concerning the COVID virus. If you did not hear last night's program with James Corbett, then I suggest you download it. It's very important. Here's some of the reasons why we should be concerned about how we've been treated and misinformation that has been given. Yes, the coronavirus is real. Yes, it's killed thousands of people. But no, it is not the flu pandemic. And by putting everyone in their home, we frequently created a problem worse than what we had with the virus itself, which up to this point, when I'm reading statistics, I do not see, though it can be highly virulent and easily spread. The people who have died principally have been those who are older with comorbidities. But the CDC, quote, admitted they made mistakes with the COVID infection counts and intentionally misled the public and have apologized, clarifying that the amount of people truly infected is much lower than what was originally reported. An error so egregious it made the director of the Harvard Global Health Institute say, quote, how could the CDC make this mistake? This is a mess, end quote. The American COVID co-virus task force also admitted to fudging the national COVID death count when Dr. Birx said the deaths are people who died with COVID, not from COVID, thus making the real death count much lower than what is currently being reported. Dr. Anthony Fauci admitted masks won't help against the virus. Mask and manufacturers are now including warnings that their products do not deter COVID-19. You have to understand, many of these masks that people are wearing, they are only really good if you sneeze or cough, or people sneeze or cough at in your direction. A cough or a sneeze can go about 12 feet, from 9 to 12 feet. Normal conversation, it's about 6 feet at the most. Most bacteria and viruses out of your mouth and water droplets drop in about 3 feet. So therefore, you're not stopping a virus which is much smaller in the micron size than the pores in the mask can filter out. Now, I wear a 100 mask, and it's hard to breathe in it. And if I'm on an airplane, I'll wear it, and with a couple other backup systems to help. But for all intents and purposes, the masks have been oversold, and they have not shown with scientific proof of what type of mask will prevent a virus from escaping your body and being put into the air on surfaces, areas which can infect other people. So it's just bad science. And also, the CDC backtracked their initial claim that led governors to shut down their states and clarify that COVID does not spread easily on surfaces. And Governor of New York Cuomo confirmed a recent health study showing 70% of new infections actually originate at home, thus making stay-at-home orders one of the most dangerous mandates currently in place. So you see, we have to understand that we have laid off over 40 million people, been laid off or furloughed. 60 million are on food stamps. Unemployment, the official unemployment is 14.7% or 13.4%, but it's actually closer to 30%. And if you work one single hour a week, you're considered employed. That's how fraudulent the statistics are. So people working short hours are considered fully employed. So you can't believe that. It's ruined the tourist industry. It's crippled the petroleum industry, which is not a bad thing, except we're going to come in and pay trillions of dollars to bail them out. And this is a perfect time for us to put a Marshall Plan together for wave power, which we have plenty of, which is non-polluting around all of our coasts and even in Lake Michigan, and also geothermal for all these hot springs that we have all over the country, thousands upon thousands, and new types of wind power without blades, so they're not killing millions of birds each year, causing environmental eyesores. And you can get smaller versions that people can use on their own homes, and also new types of solar, including solar paint that you can spray on your home. So that's what we've done, and in effect, we've taken away a lot of liberties of people that should have been taken away. Also, millions at risk as melting Pakistan glaciers raise flood fears. This is from Al Jazeera, quote, "As ice melts, there's risk of large glacial lakes bursting through banks and creating deadly flash floods downstream. Late last month, residents of the tiny village in Pakistan Mountains, Hunza District, noticed floodwaters quickly rising in the stream that runs near their homes, carrying water from the towering Shispur Glacier. Quote, the flows became so high that they eroded the land and reached 10 feet, that's 3 meters, from my family's home. We evacuated. The ensuing flood, carrying huge boulders from the melting glacier, demolished the cherry, apricot, and walnut orchards many families depend upon and left homes, cracks, 16 families in tents, and local irrigation and hydropower damaged. Now, mind you, this has never happened before, but this is one of the phenomena of global warming. All of the large ice and snow packs of the Himalayas are melting at a very fast rate, and the water has to go someplace, so it's going in to the reservoirs and then overflowing these dams, causing massive damage, and nothing is being done about it. It's just one of the problems. Then I wanted to share something from a Brandon Smith in Alt Market. It's an article entitled, Why the Public Should Rebel Against Forced Vaccinations. Quote, the debate over the mortality, the morality and practicality of forced vaccination has been raging for many years, long before the coronavirus ever hit the U.S. population. With the advent of this pandemic and the narrative has shifted to one of necessity. The media and the majority of governments around the world now act as if mass vaccinations are a given. Quote, the debate is over, as collectivists like to say when they are tired of having to deal with any logical and factual complaints. In the case of the novel coronavirus, there is no vaccine yet, unless, of course, the virus was engineered or evolved in a lab, as more and more evidence is suggesting. And then perhaps there is one already developed. Typically, vaccines take years to test and produce, and whenever a vaccine is rushed onto the market, very bad things tend to happen. The vaccine debate often revolves around the issue of safety. Is a particular inoculation safe or poisonous? Does it have long-term effects that are dangerous? Does it harm children with highly sensitive and underdeveloped body systems? These are valid concerns, but ultimately the fight over vaccines has less to do with medical safety or efficacy and more to do with individual rights versus government demands. In other words, the more important questions are, should social engineering by governments and elites be allowed? Do people have the right to determine how their bodies are medically augmented or manipulated? Does the security of the majority take precedence over the civil liberties of the individual? And if so, who gets to determine what freedoms will be taken away? The purveyors of the forced vaccination philosophy usually make a legal or technical argument first before they appeal to the idea of the greater good. They do this because they know that public perception often assumes wrongly that legal authority is the same as moral authority. In 2005, the U.S. Supreme Court was presented with Jacobson versus Massachusetts, a case involving the subject of state-enforced smallpox vaccination. The defendant argued on the grounds of the 14th Amendment that his body, his liberty to use that body was being violated by the state if he was subjected to arbitrary vaccination without his consent. The state and the Supreme Court felt differently. Of course, the Supreme Court ruled against Jacobson on the grounds that his refusal to take the vaccine put other people at risk and that for the common good, states have certain police powers that supersede personal liberties. So whenever liberty movement activists argue against forced vaccination on constitutional grounds, this is the counter-argument that the government and statists will make. They will bring up Jacobson versus Massachusetts and claim that that is the end of the discussion. Essentially, the Supreme Court argued that the federal government could not interfere with state-imposed forced vaccinations on the grounds of states' rights in the 10th Amendment. Most people in the liberty movement will find this rather ironic, as it is bizarre to hear about the federal government defending state rights, but this support of the 10th Amendment is highly selective. First, let's not forget the Supreme Court has been wrong many times in the past. In the Dred Scott case in 1834, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of slavery and the right of states to enforce the institution of slavery. They also argued that the Fifth Amendment protected slave owners because freeing slaves meant depriving owners of their property. The Supreme Court's habit is to defend states' rights and the Tenth Amendment when people's individual liberties are being quashed. However, if a case involves states protecting citizens from federal intrusion, the court flips and attacks states' rights when they work in favor of individual liberty or self-determination. So the Jacobson versus Massachusetts case may be the reason why Trump and the federal government have mostly left the lockdowns and the emergency actions to the states. The legal precedence was already established in 1905 on quarantines and forcing vaccinations through state police powers. So it only follows that the establishment would utilize the states to carry out such measures in the near future. So the states versus federal government debate sets up a false paradigm. There is no separation between state and federal governments when it comes to tyranny. Both sides love it, though they pretend to be opposed to each other at times. That is to say, whether it is the federal government violating your constitutional rights or the state government violating your constitutional rights, the Supreme Court is often comfortable with both. The truth they don't want to discuss is that at the bottom of the Bill of Rights overrules them regardless of federal precedent or the 10th Amendment. The key to the Bill of Rights is that each American citizen has inherent liberties that supersede both federal and state power. These rights are inalienable. They cannot be violated today, and the law cannot be adjusted to violate them tomorrow. These rights and freedoms are eternal. The Supreme Court hisses with a forked tongue about the spirit of the Constitution, but ignores the clear and concrete intent as stated by the founders. Statists argue in favor of the living document philosophy when it suits them as a means to change the original meaning and laws put forth in the Bill of Rights because this allows them to violate citizens' freedoms under the guise of legality. But legality is not the same as morality. Legality is meaningless, and the Supreme Court is meaningless if it acts against the constitutional bedrock of the Bill of Rights and individual liberty, as they've done numerous times in the past. So if we cannot rely on legality to protect us from state tyranny, what can we rely upon? Forced vaccine advocates will say that morality is on their side as well. For if a person does not vaccinate, they are putting the rest of society at risk of infection. Therefore, your individual rights must be violated in order to protect the rights of the rest of society. The problem is that Jacobson versus Massachusetts makes no logical argument supporting this assertion, and neither do forced vaccine proponents. Look at it this way. How can a person that is not vaccinated harm people that are vaccinated? How are they putting those people at risk? If the vaccine actually works, then vaccinated people are safe from infection, aren't they? So the only person at risk is the person that chose not to be vaccinated. This comes down to personal choice. There is no question of the greater good or social risk. I find it fascinating the people that argue fervently in favor of forced vaccinations like Bill Gates also tend to be the same people that argue in favor of euthanasia, for example, of some form. So that's it. You should be thinking, because they're coming, and when they're coming with a mandate that all people must be vaccinated or pay a price to society. Also, there was an interesting news story from the University College Cork, which is in Great Britain. They reviewed the health risks of radio frequency radiation employed in 5G technology and the implementation. And what they found was really interesting. In effect, what they said, and this is from the University College Cork, which is in Ireland. I was thinking Bath, but it's actually Cork. Beautiful community. And this is a Professor Thomas Butler. He says, this short critical review explores the findings of extant research on the health risks posed by 5G technologies that emit radio frequency radiation. It also provides evidence that the processes by which, listen carefully what he says, that the evidence that the processes by which policy decisions have been made concerning the protection of the public health may be significantly flawed, as the overwhelming body of scientific evidence appears to have been ignored by relevant government departments and agencies in arriving at decisions about the introduction of 5G. This lacuna comes about due to the over-reliance on expert opinion from the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, an NGO, that's non-governmental organization, whose members have traditionally cut close ties to the industry. It is significant that the UK government and its agencies neither sought nor obtained independent scientific evidence on a matter of importance to public health. Consequently, it failed in its duty to identify, assess, and mitigate the risks posed by radio frequency-based technologies before the introduction, specifically 5G networking and related technologies, thereby protecting public health. Then he has a whole thing here. What does science have to say about the health risk of 5G? And then there's like seven paragraphs of everything that is wrong with 5G. I mean, serious stuff. Cancers, all types of carcinogenicity, brain tumors, gliomas, breast cancer, acoustic neuromas, leukemia, parotid gland tumors, genotoxicity, DNA damage, DNA repair inhibition, mutagenesis, neurodegenerative diseases, Alzheimer's, ALS, autism, reproductive problems, pregnancy outcomes, etc. So I just want to let you know, we're posting this on PRN.fm, that a very important scientific study that no one is going to talk about, no one's going to use, is a matter of fact. It's a matter of the record. It was published in a peer-reviewed journal from a major university by a respected scientist, and no one is touching that in the mainstream media. But at least you know, and you can download it. In North America and Europe, the direct impact of enforcing lockdowns has resulted in dozens of petty arrests and some fines and a dab of overzealous policing. Yet in some African states, the police brutality that has come along with enforced lockdowns has already claimed more lives than the COVID virus. In Uganda, police have shot lockdown breakers. Five policemen were arrested in Rwanda on suspicion of beating up local men and raping their wives. And in Kenya, police shot dead a 13-year-old boy for playing on his balcony a few minutes after the beginning of the curfew. And despite many Western media outlets showering the South African government with praise for its supposed ruthlessly efficient response to the coronavirus, videos have emerged of police firing rubber bullets onto crowds, and the government's own police complaints agency is currently investigating an instance of a man who was beaten to death with a hammer for leaving his home for just a few minutes. The number of accounts like these could fill a small book already. So that's what's happening in Africa. Wrong approach to what should have been done to help the people there. And that's unfortunate. Now, also, I want to bring this up. Amid calls for police reform, new data set shows where police money has flowed in Congress. This is from Center for Responsive Politics from Grace Haley and Ian Carbo. Quote, police reform is now a congressional priority following a nationwide protest against police violence and systematic racism after the killing of George Floyd by Minneapolis police. Many of the protests in cities across the country, including Washington, D.C., have been met with militarized force and violence. Black Lives Matter, one of the main organizing bodies behind the protest, has long fought for transparency and accountability in response to police violence against black communities. With Floyd's death, the group is calling for a nationwide defunding of police departments. Now, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced plans for legislation to be introduced, with drafting efforts being led by members of the Congressional Black Caucus. The bill is expected to address qualified immunity, a legal doctrine that protects officers from repercussions after the use of force, as well as training requirements and bans on excessive use of force such as chokeholds. Legislation is likely to pass the Democratic-controlled House, but its fate in the Senate is less certain. Senator Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he's open to reviewing legislation, but has yet to make any further comment regarding specific motivations. Police unions are expected to rally against the proposed reforms, key among them the National Fraternal Order of Police, which represents over 351,000 members and has four full-time lobbyists on staff. But the union's power extends beyond lobbying. They fund and endorse candidates and hold sway over the contributions of the hundreds of thousands of law enforcement officers around the country. And since 1994 election cycle, 55 police union and law enforcement PACs have donated over $1.1 million to congressional campaigns, more than a third of which has gone to current members of Congress. Funds spread to both sides of the aisle, especially to those in prominent positions and with influence in the House Law Enforcement Caucus. Another $9 million in itemized contributions come from those listing current or retired law enforcement positions as their profession. So that's what we're faced with. And so millions and millions of dollars the police and the unions and the lobbyists have given. So how likely is it that real reform, real transformation, not allowing our police to be trained by the Israelis, completely changing the way police are put into academy and the tests they're given, the input they're given, giving them non-lethal ways of handling situations instead of always a shoot to kill, and also why not select members to patrol communities from communities? In other words, hire people from a community, go back into community without all the armor, without all the protection, and work with community leaders. Have civilian control over that situation in every community in the United States. That would be one way to start the transformation. Then we have to work at the other areas like the justice system itself and the inequality and racism within the sentencing and the prison system, the private prison system, debtors' prisons, the debt peonage and everything else that comes with it. For all of you, this is the program. Everyone's invited to the table. Have a nice day, everyone.